Welcome to another episode of Conduct Detrimental. I am Dan Lust, and this time we are joined by, we'll say, a three-headed monster of Mike Lawson, Stephanie Weissenberger, and Taryn Sharma. What's up, gang?
What's up, gang?
What's up, gang? That's great. An homage to our TikTok page.
Yeah, shout out Taryn for starting that.
Okay. Well, this we call it a special edition. We'll say this is we do some fun things online once upon a time, and unbeknownst to me, there was a very hungry audience for the Free Britney hashtag. I've never had a post on Instagram with more engagement. I literally wrote two words. I wrote breaking, and I had a little siren emoji, and I wrote Free Britney. And that post on Instagram has literally five times more engagement than anything I've ever gotten on Instagram. So we did a little poll, and the poll said, should we cover this on the next podcast? And shockingly, 97% of people said that they wanted this on the podcast. And shockingly, Rachel's friends who follow me out of pity said, wow, you've actually posted something I'm interested in. And I will actually listen to the podcast if you talk about this. So not only we talk about Britney, but we might talk about, might come up, Dave Portnoy, Barstool, deposition, interesting, and Lil Nas X, the blood shoe, because we tend to mix it up here on Conduct Detrimental. But before we get into the fun stuff, team, isn't this kind of nice? Dan Wallach's not here, so the kids can play.
We like to have fun here.
Yeah, we like to have fun here, but Taryn, just have to follow up on, I know we discussed last time, the eggs, are you at over under? What's your take now? Over under eggs on Dan Snyder?
I feel like he's getting a little bit of protection from the NFL, that big shield coming into handy of late.
Physical shield, like a bubble over his house shield. Well, that's
not trees.
That'll set us up for what should be a lovely episode of the podcast. So we have five topics to hit today. First and foremost, I don't know, maybe my worst enemy / my best friend. He's definitely a hate follow on Instagram. That is my friend Tony Busby. We're going to talk about all things Deshaun Watson. And then as we had them on last time, Stephanie and Taryn, this is a Dan Snyder episode. We have to have those guys on. And Lil Nas X, I didn't realize that Mike was such a sneakerhead. Mike's going to help break that down. Then there's a group breakdown of Free Britney, and then we're going to get into what not to do at a deposition when you have Dave Portnoy on the stand. That's going to be the Barstool Rappaport section. So lots to get into. I will lead us off. So on the Watson level, Deshaun Watson, anyone, I'm sure anyone listening to this podcast is familiar with the case. At this stage, as of what's today? Today is Tuesday. We had 19 lawsuits, civil lawsuits that were filed. The DA's office had not picked up the case as of today. More on that later. I think we might know why they have not picked it up. But I think as of, so we spoke about this a little bit last week. The substance of the allegations hasn't changed as the number has gone up. In this most recent round of complaints that came in, and obviously we said it last podcast, it's still weird that he's gaining clients in a week, right? Someone signs up the firm. You don't need to send out a complaint within a week of getting a new client. So I don't know. I can keep singing, getting on my soapbox, but I just said something very weird about Tony Busby. But yeah, so, you know, he files these three new complaints. And in the complaints, there are allegations that Deshaun Watson deleted Instagram messages and that he was directly in contact with some of the victims to settle these cases, which it's a no-no. He shouldn't be settling the cases for a number of levels and obviously should not be deleting Instagram messages. Rusty Hardin, his lawyer, came back and essentially said, well, everyone deletes Instagram messages, and rest assured, Deshaun Watson hasn't deleted a single Instagram message since March 15th, the day of the first lawsuit, which we'll get into it, but it's not really a normal response on his part. And then we had a story surface. We'll get into all of this, but the story surface about an individual who is also an accuser who decided not to sign up with the Busby Law Firm. So we have, we'll say, an independent accuser. And then last but not least, the reason that we might be a little more tired than we normally are on this podcast, it was delayed 15 minutes because of some breaking Busby news. This is why you sign up for Busby notifications, because you might get a little buzz on your phone. And it's not a vibration. It's Busby doing something stupid to mess up the case. So it's not, I'm not on either side. I'm not a Busby side. I'm not a Watson side. I'm on just like, don't make the profession look really bad. So I'm going to open this up to the floor. What are everyone's overall thoughts on the chaos that Busby has created?
I mean, first off, I think we should talk a little bit more about the Sports Illustrated article that was released yesterday with this new allegation that's not connected to Tony Busby and the other 19 lawsuits. She's unsure whether she's even going
this to- This is pursue. Mary, right? We're calling
yes,
Mary?
This is Mary. That is not her real name, all confidential, but Sports Illustrated did look into these claims and text messages, Instagram DMs, talked to a family member that she had spoken to immediately after leaving that massage that day. And the stories all align. So, I mean, it's interesting. And I think that it's kind of sad that, you know, these women are coming forward and it's obviously great. So much respect for them coming forward. But it's unfortunate that I think Tony Busby's strategy, tactics, whatever you may call it, are kind of overshadowing a lot of this because he's just putting out false claim after false claim and there's nothing really behind anything that he's shown so far. And so I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. And just to go off of that, Jenny Varenta said Sports Illustrated is a really well-regarded reporter and seems to have done a really good job checking this allegation. And it really does, like you said, Steph, fit with the pattern that we've seen in a lot of these allegations. And so one thing that you mentioned, I want to come back to the fact that she went to Busby with this story initially and then decided not to proceed with him and felt as though he was or the firm was pressuring her to go along with it. I think that that is worrisome for Watson because now, since she's hired another attorney, it seems like now Watson's going to have to fight this on multiple fronts.
Has she hired another attorney?
Apparently she's working with UA Lewis, a civil rights attorney, to explore her options, okay. Said the Sports Illustrated article.
Yeah, so she hasn't really decided whether she's going to move forward yet, but I think that it will be concerning for Watson if he's having to defend something that's a very common theme, but it's somebody who's not going to maybe be dragged down by some of the tactics that we've mentioned or how that person is viewed in the media and by the public.
Well, that was my initial reaction when I saw the Sports Illustrated was the fact that she chose not to go with Busby. Like Taryn, you just said that hurts Watson big time because everybody has been talking from the beginning when Busby was like, we're not going to, you know, this is not going to be heard in the, you know, the court of public opinion. That's exactly what this case has been doing. And the more cases that came out, people were like, wow, we're really seeing a pattern. But there was also the claims against Busby, especially in the legal field, saying that these are just copycat claims. These are verbatim every single, you know, summons and complaint. It was the same exact, you know, fact pattern. And everyone was like, well, that's a good thing. You know, that's a good thing for these plaintiffs because it's showing a pattern that he's doing this. That's not true. There was a legitimate claim saying that Busby was just filing copycat claims. So this Sports Illustrated actually hurts Watson because it is now showing a pattern, a true pattern, and that plaintiffs aren't just signing up with Busby to hop on board this copycat claim train, whether these are true allegations or not. And there's a, I think what Busby tried to do when he posted on Instagram saying he's like not going to hear this in the court of public opinion, it just backfired because everything, it's too public for that to even happen. I mean, you have horrible, like nasty opinions that happen in the public, people who are in the legal field or people who are not. It's just not a good thing, especially when it comes to like picking a jury, because there's already going to be a jury who's like has some sort of biased opinion. So I don't even know how, if it gets to that point, that they're going to pick an unbiased jury.
Here's something that really just angers me about this Busby. He gets his foot in his mouth. Like, this is not Tony Busby. It's not a case about Tony Busby, but it is. Like, that's the story. And I have so many people dropping in my replies, like, if the victims lose this case, and there might be some legitimate, you know, accusers and some non-legitimate, but the legitimate ones are going to be losing this because of I'm going to call it ineffective lawyering of Busby. He leads us off, Mike, and you said the part that maybe that just irks me from the beginning. He's like, we're not going to litigate this case in the press. Just look at the complaints, read the complaints. Okay, sounds good, Busby. Go dark from Instagram for about 72 hours, okay? And then we can say that we're not litigating the case in the press. So the only thing I can gather is that he's trying to get off on a technicality. Like, well, litigating the press to me, I mean, it means using a press release, and I'm using Instagram, and I'm also posting about my horses and my dog. So I'm obviously not litigating the case on social media. So Busby, I don't want to call the guy a liar, but like, he's doing a lot of things that one would do if they would be called a liar. So I'm not calling him a liar, but he seems to have a lot of characteristics that liars would have. That's just my two cents.
And that seems like a common refrain. Even tonight in his Instagram post that was breaking, he said, pay attention to our public filings rather than the lawyer statements in the media. So what does he mean by that? Is he saying, like, pay attention to what he does and not what he says? Is he admitting that he is saying some things that are nonsense? In that case, like, we've looked at the complaints and they are largely similar. Some might even say it's a cut and paste job. And so later on in this statement, he's also saying that he's afraid that HPD is going to leak the names to Russ Harden because Harden's son works there.
He's entitled to the names. He will get the names in discovery. Like, why can't he get... I want to walk a fine line because there might be people that listen to this that think that I'm somehow on Watson's side going after the victims. It's a civil case and Watson has a right to defend himself. I'm not even talking about the substantive truth of the allegations. The number one thing that he would get in discovery, the first thing, not even the second thing, not the third thing, he'd get the victim's name so he could defend the case. Now, does he have to wait in New York, you have to wait 21 days. It's 21 days, 30 days, whatever, to get discovery, right? This is the most public case. And by not giving him the names, he's extending this case out even longer. So the only way you can read into this, the only way, and this is why it's this little Busby, like onomatopoeia here, like his name is Busby. Just give him the names, professional courtesy. Like just give the man the names. And guess what? Like, here's what, I'm going to get off my me getting angry for a second. And then I guess we can transition. I haven't even talked about what Busby did. Busby went out and said today that there are two conflicts, and Taryn, you hit on them. One is that he ran for mayoral campaign, guys, 2018 mayoral campaign, right around there, a couple years ago.
2019.
So guess what? It was at some point before the first accuser came to him because these allegations are in March of 2020. So presumably this man knew that he had a conflict with the police department a year ago. Okay. So he's saying, well, I bashed I think his name is Acevedo, the police chief at Houston Police Department. And I bashed him and I called for him to step down when I was running for mayor and I didn't win mayor. And, you know, I kind of think the Houston Police Department hates me. So I'm not really sure I should bring a case to the Houston Police Department because they hate me. Shocking. Shocking that would be the case when you told the police chief, their boss, to step down. So that's maybe a conflict, right? Okay. Maybe you shouldn't be on the case, Tony Busby, if this is a case that involves sexual assault and you feel uncomfortable bringing it to the Houston Police Department. Okay, that's number one. Number two, right? Rusty Harden's son works in some capacity. Rusty Harden is the lawyer for Deshaun Watson, works in some capacity for the Houston Police Department. Okay, like, congrats. What's going to happen? Like, so, you know, guess what? If Busby needs to recuse himself from the case, that's fine. I have no problem with that. I would actually love that because then we can have some effective lawyering on both sides. And I don't even know if Rusty Harden's any good. I just know he's not doing Busbyisms and putting his foot in his mouth or like putting his stinger in his mouth because he's Busby. So anyway, I'm off my Busby soapbox. Do we have anything else to add on this Watson front? I'm just getting annoyed at the flying insect.
I do think that it just looks odd, maybe paranoid even, that you follow up the fact that Houston PD said, no, we haven't had any contact with these alleged victims, despite Busby saying that. And then you follow that up with kind of paranoid statements of that you're worried that these names are going to get leaked. I guess maybe, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but maybe he's afraid of Watson's camp getting a head start. But like you said, they're going to get that information eventually. They need it in order to defend the case.
You can't give the guy the benefit of the doubt at this point because he's let us down in expectations, right? We always say under promise, over deliver. The guy is overpromising and underdelivering at every turn. So, Taryn, I would like to give him the benefit of the doubt. He doesn't deserve it at this point. Okay, that said, let us transition. The second topic, this one we've covered, obviously we covered Daniel Snyder a lot. There was a period of time we covered him on the podcast a couple months ago when there was the Washington Post toxic report, toxic workplace. The cheerleaders were alleging sexual harassment. And there was a leaked new cheerleader video that was put on Snyder's desk. It's all this little, breadcrumbs. And we were like, whoa, Snyder's going to have to sell the team. This is really bad. They hired Beth Wilkinson. Like, Snyder's going down in flames. Wild card. Snyder now owns 100% of the team. And the NFL seemed to be very okay with him doing this. So I'm a little baffled. Not going to lie. Did not expect this. Hopefully, fortunately, there was no way to bet on this result because I would have led you astray. I did not think this was going to happen. Our resident Washingtonians, Steph, Taryn, can you explain how this happened?
Yeah. I think that maybe the only thing that might get me as heated as how Busby gets you is Dan Snyder. But like you said, both of these competing timelines, the sexual harassment investigation, the minority shareholder dispute, they really seem to be reaching a resolution. There was a lot of chatter, as you mentioned, that Snyder was going to be forced out by the NFL owners for failures on both ends of that. But it appears that's not going to be the case. Snyder is going to pay approximately $875 million to purchase the shares that are held by a group of minority shareholders, most notably FedEx CEO Fred Smith. And that was made possible because the NFL's finance committee unanimously recommended to the owners that they waive their debt limits. That's going to allow Snyder to take on an additional $450 million worth of debt that's going to be due in March 2028. In November, the Washington Post had reported that a group of investors from California had offered $900 million for those same shares. And the NFL is going to be levying a fine in this sale price upon the minority owners because they took their dispute to court. They took it to federal district court in Maryland instead of going through arbitration. So if you do a little bit of back of the envelope math, you can look at it, 900 million minus the 875 price that they're going to receive. So that fine is somewhere around $25 million. So the way I see it, there are two ways that this goes. Snyder is here to stay. That's probably the most seamless outcome and maybe the most likely one. Or two, the NFL determined that a 100% sale further down the road is going to be easier to market than a piecemeal sale of 60% and 40%. So Steph, as a fellow DC area native, where do you think that this wild ride is going to take us next?
Well, I think it's interesting too that, you know, the Beth Wilkinson report from the NFL investigation, you know, first we talked about she was originally hired by Snyder to do some sort of independent investigation. I don't understand how that makes sense considering he was the one that first hired her, but continued on with Wilkinson with the NFL. And that report is supposed to come out soon. You know, there were some rumblings that they were going to recommend he sell the team. That clearly isn't going to happen, or at least I don't think so. But just a little side bit that I came across from the Cranky Redskins fan guide earlier. Did you know that Snyder was selling bankrupt airline peanuts to fans at FedEx Field in 2006? Because neither did I. And I was a little bit floored by the fact that the vendors were offering these nuts in royal blue and white bags adorned with the Independence Air logo, yet that airline had actually gone out of business a year earlier. And then apparently, according to the Peanut Council, the recommended shelf life of a foil bag of out-of-shell peanuts is 3 months.
So when we were talking about claims of a toxic workplace, you actually think we should investigate toxic concession stands as well?
I think so.
Nothing would surprise me about Dan Snyder, the guy who sues grandmas who have gone bankrupt for not renewing their season tickets.
Besides the the facts that are kind of publicly out there of, you know, it's three owners, right? So you mentioned Fred Smith. There's also Dwight Schar and Robert Rothman. Robert Rothman, I think, is the Black Diamond Investments company. And then Dwight Schar is NVR Incorporated, which is the third largest home builder in the U.S. So those are the three minorities. They own 40.5%. He's going to pay him $900 million. It's a sweet deal. Like, if anything, Dan Snyder should be paying for Roger Goodell's dinners for the rest of his life. It's definitely a get out of jail free card for Snyder. And Forbes reported that they had two sources, one being an NFL owner and the other being a prominent banker, saying that after all said and done, after all the new NFL deals and the valuation of the Redskins, which earlier, September of last year, Forbes valued the Redskins at like $3.5 billion. Now, I think after all the sales, especially with the percentages, the percentage of the sale and what he's paying for it, the valuation, I think, drops to $2.8 billion. I might be wrong exactly on the number, but Forbes reported, I think yesterday or the day before, saying that after all said and done, after he has 100% ownership, he could sell the Redskins for $4 billion. So that's $500 million more than Forbes valued them last year. And after all the sales and all this kind of fleshes out, that's a high valuation on the Redskins.
Absolutely. So, Mike, let me ask you a question. You mentioned Goodell. Do you think that allowing Snyder to take 100% control is part of the whole protect the shield mantra of Goodell's?
Goodell is very good. I wouldn't say very good. He's good at controlling chaos, I would say. Definitely better than some other league. Maybe a particular baseball. I thought Dan was going to jump in on that one. So Rob Manfred, I'm talking about Rob Manfred. So Goodell is very good at kind of minimizing chaos as fast as possible. So this was definitely a way for Goodell to control the situation and just saying, you know, squash, you know, just flat out squash the ugly legal battle that is happening between the owners and Snyder. And I think this just pushes it to probably Goodell saying, like, Snyder, you're going to sell the team. Like, you're not keeping this team. So for sale, whether it's under, you know, that's behind closed doors, but this is definitely going to force that to happen.
I'm going to disagree. I think you are, Mike, clearly a glass half full guy. And in the year that I've known you, Mike, also shout out, we hit our 1 year, I guess, glass quarter full as you were showing me your glass. But Mike and I had our 1 year LinkedIn anniversary, we'll call it that. I've known you to be a glass half full guy. Now, as the realist in the room, there was no chance that Dan Snyder is selling the team. There was no chance because he got hit with the worst bombs and the worst shots from every single angle. The NFL investigated him and the toxic workplace, the sexual nude cheerleading video, and all those stories, nobody seems to care because he now has 100% control of the team. If they were going to force him to sell, this would have been the time when the world was against him, the you know, sponsors were dropping. He's not going to sell the team. So I know, Mike, you're trying to make Steph and Taryn feel better. Go ahead.
Well, no. Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing about forcing the sale right now. And maybe basically the minority owners, as it currently stands, they have tag along rights, which I'll explain in a second. But basically, as it sits right now, if they're still fighting over for sale or the minority owners and Dan Snyder, the legal battle that's getting extremely ugly. So right now, the three that I just mentioned, Dwight Schar, Robert Rothman, Fred Smith, they have tag along rights. So if the team sold, if Goodell forced Snyder to sell his majority position in the Redskins, their tag along rights, they would have the right to also put forth their minority shares and tag along on and sell their share of the team. So if like I said, if Snyder's selling at this point, then they could sell their stake in the team And then what they would do is they do a control stake value, which is whatever the NFL determines the value of their percentage of that team to be, which is currently low. But if they wait, it's going to go up with all of the deals that the media deals that the NFL is making, on top of the fact that the NFL is now a 17-game season. So the fact that this is happening now, I think, is definitely strategic in the sense that Snyder, even more that Snyder should be literally paying for dinner for Goodell for the rest of his life, because the fact that this is happening gives more money in the pockets, because the Redskins' control stake value, 100% of owning the Redskins, is going to go through the roof now that they have higher media deals because they have an extra game on their season.
You can say all those fancy terms and tag-alongs, not the Girl Scout cookies. If anyone was
curious, they were the Girl Scout cookies.
Those are delicious Girl Scout
cookies. Those are the best. Those are the best ones.
Tag-alongs, the Samoas.
Samoas, yeah, tag-alongs.
My man.
I can go either way. But, you know, you can say fancy terms like tag-alongs, and maybe you could say, like, oh, they have Samoa rights. I don't even know what that is, but you can make that up as well. He's not selling the team. Like, not. James Dolan's not selling the Knicks. Dan Snyder's not selling the Washington football team. It's just not happening. I'm happy to be wrong. But I track stories that we cover. We've probably covered Dan Snyder as a solo topic more than we've covered anything else. And he still owns the team. That tells you all you
need. Can I just say one thing about that? I think that it might be harder in the sports where there is a ton of revenue sharing and a common TV deal for owners to be forced to sell the team due to whatever reason. I think it's easier in a sport like baseball where every team is they revenue share, but they're self-reliant for their own TV deals. Because if an owner is not, if they don't have enough money, like the Wilpons didn't have enough money, then they can eventually lose control of the team and get possible. $2 billion for it.
Very possible. But you know, I think baseball teams, I mean, we'll see. The money coming into football is going to be ridiculous. So we'll see if that changes anything. Okay. So now this is the portion of our show where we probably wouldn't normally cover these topics. Mike, I'm going to turn it over to you. I'm just going to say this. I'm not a sneakerhead by any means. I did see a post that went across my timeline a couple days ago that they were putting drops of human blood in a shoe. And I just thought it was interesting. I didn't think anything of it because it had nothing attached to law. And you know, my mind works. It works in sports and law. And I didn't see either in a blood in a shoe tweet. But then, Mike, it fell in the sports radar. Ah, it fell in the sports law radar. Okay, Mike, tell us about blood, shoe, Satan, all that fun stuff.
What we have is a trademark infringement case. So not directly sports law, but it is entertainment and sports law is the umbrella of this niche area of law. We cover that sports law sector, but this is, I would say, trademark falls under all sports and entertainment, but this kind of leans more to the entertainment only because of the association of Lil Nas X. So what we have is Nike versus MSCHF Product Studio Incorporated. So MSCHF, for the rest of this, I'm going to call it Mischief because that's basically what they go by, Mischief. To preface this, it's a bunch of trademark statutes that they're claiming. Trademark is a federal statute, so like United States Code. So like when people say like 17 USC, all this stuff. So Nike is claiming that Mischief has basically infringed on their trademark, being the Nike swoosh and the Nike shoe. This is the Nike Air Max 97. And basically what they said was they took the Nike Air Max, made it their own, and then sold it as if Nike was selling it themselves. So there is a tarnishment involved here. That's a trademark claim called dilution, which is basically them saying that the mark that Mischief is putting out, they're advertising it as if Nike was doing that, and it is tarnishing the Nike claim. Now, why are they doing this? Well, Mischief has partnered Lil Nas X, and they made this Satan shoe. Now, basically what they did was they took a black Nike Air Max 97, and they put red accents on it. They put an upside down cross. They put a Satan pendant on the tongue, and then they also put on their Luke 10:18, which is a scripture which says that he replied, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. On every shoe, they have Luke 10:18, and they also have a certain number /666. Now, obviously, 666 is the number of the beast. That is a satanic number. And they sold, apparently, 666 of these styled shoes. Also to note, inside of the shoe, they put, I think they said 60 cc's and one drop of human blood. Now, upon further research, there are six total project managers on this shoe, and they gave them little prickers that every single day they took little drops of blood out of their fingers and put a literal human drop of blood inside of the midsole of the shoe that was red ink, and then this one drop of blood. So basically, these dropped, today is March 30th, these dropped March 29th, and Nike and their legal team at Arnold and Porter was very quick with this complaint that this was already blowing up and destroying and tarnishing the Nike, you know, emblem, the Nike company, and basically every company has goodwill that they build up. And you'll hear that's a legal term. It's basically their fan base, their following. Some people buy a shoe strictly for the purpose that it has the Nike swoosh on it, not even knowing that it's not affiliated with Nike. So when you have a company like this, like Mischief, who is repurposing a Nike shoe and then selling it as their own, somebody sees that shoe and just thinks it's coming from Nike. So you had in the complaint, also, if anybody is interested in reading the complaint, they have screenshots of Twitter, Reddit, and Instagram. So maybe you're famous now because if you commented saying you're never going to buy Nikes again because they support satanic, like Satanism and satanic rituals or something like that, it could be in there because they posted a bunch of different comments of people saying they're throwing away anything there. So just a couple more things before I get off my soapbox here. So Nike is basically saying that they are...
What's the evil version of the soapbox? So like the demon box?
I don't know. The
dirt box.
Yeah.
Dirt box. Yeah, sandbox.
Dirt box. Get off your dirt box.
Nike is claiming that Mischief and its unauthorized Satan shoes are likely to cause confusion and dilution and create an erroneous association between Mischief's product and Nike. In the short time since the announcement, which was literally yesterday, of the Satan shoes, Nike has suffered significant harm to its goodwill, including among customers who believe that Nike is endorsing Satanism. Now, to note, Mischief, this is not the first time that they've done this to the Nike Air Max 97. They also made the Jesus shoe in 2019, in which it was the same exact, but it was a white Nike Air Max 97, and that inside the midsole, they put holy water.
Where did they get the holy water, Mike? Did they prick Jesus?
No, I think it was probably blessed by some priest, but I have no idea. So with that, a lot of people are saying that Mischief can use the fact that they sold these shoes as kind of a defense that Nike didn't sue us here, so we thought it was okay that we could do this. However, that's not really going to work because there was really no tarnishment, significantly less backlash, and really no like boycott threats against Nike because it's just a Jesus shoe. Some people would be like, "Oh, you support Jesus," but it's not as, I guess, dark as a satanic ritual. Maybe I don't know. I don't think that's gonna hold up. What they could do is an argument under the first sale doctrine. So this is a lot of legal jargon and trademark law. I think it's really interesting personally. I think if you read through this and kind of go through the US codes of what possibly could happen, but under 17 USC 109, the first sale doctrine is basically what allows consumers to resell items, if you will. So basically what I can do is I can take a Nike shoe and put my spin on it. Maybe I want to make it like logos of teams that I enjoy. And if somebody liked that and wanted to buy that, I could do that. That's a first sale. So that's a one-off sale that I'm doing. I'm putting my own personal spin on it and I'm selling it for $500. So that happens a lot, especially in the sneaker world. And Nike knows about that. However, with that, it's once you take a product, Nike's, a copyrighted product, and then you infringe on their copyright and change it and dispose of it in a way that really doesn't protect the interests of the copyright owner, that removes this defense of the first sale doctrine. So basically, the first sale doctrine never protects a defendant who makes unauthorized reproductions of the copyrighted work. Again, a lot of legal jargon, but basically it prevents what happens here with the Satan shoes. Now, with the Jesus shoe, they only sold 24, so it's also significantly less. Here they sold 666, so that's a different argument for the first sale, but they're not gonna have any defense here. It's gonna have some sort of settlement. I do wanna note, and then I really will get off my sandbox.
Dirt box.
The funniest line out of this entire, it's 24 pages, out of the entire complaint is this right here. Quote, Nike says in their complaint, this is regarding adding the red dye and blood into the shoe. Making changes to the midsole may pose safety risks for consumers. That is what they put in quotes because somehow they puncture the midsole and might make the shoe less functionable. And then Nike would be liable because the shoe caused somebody to break their ankle. I don't know.
I just wanted to say that that was O.J. Simpson's excuse for having blood on his shoes, that he had the Lil Nas X Satan shoes in 1994. Just very ahead of the curve.
Okay. So, Mike, excellent, excellent breakdown. There's a couple things that people need to know because I don't think anyone wants to own up to this. I'll own up to it. I'm an adult. I can own up to this. When I first saw the shoe, I am not like, you know, the biggest sneakerhead. I thought there was, I'm like, well, how is Nike condoning this? Like, and maybe it was because Lil Nas X was connected to it. I'm like, oh, it's a musician. Like, there's some connection to Nike. So I put up a poll. I can never understand why this happens, but I put up a poll, basically identical polls on Twitter and Instagram. And I said, at any point in time, did you believe there was an affiliation, an actual affiliation between Nike and the Lil Nas X Satan series shoes? So I'm not sure which is which, but about two thirds responded that yes, they thought there were an affiliation on, I think it was Twitter, and actually the opposite result, one third thought there was an affiliation on Instagram. But either way you slice it, a third of the people at least thought there was an affiliation. So that to Mike's point tells you that there is some, you know, there's some confusion of marks. And then number two, I know it because people were dropping my replies that like their kids were like, why is like Nike supporting a satanic brand? Or like, that doesn't make sense. Mike, here, I don't know, you know, I was going to make a joke of it, but like, you know, they're obviously satanic worshipers that are into the shoe. And like, there was like the leader of this satanic tribe or cult, whatever you want to call him. He gave a quote to TMZ that like, they love the shoe. They were in support of it. It was really authentic. Maybe there was outrage at a Jesus shoe. Like, maybe I'm not saying something very controversial. Like, why do we need to have a Jesus shoe or a Satan shoe? Like, why can't we just have shoes? Like, I'm not sure. You're going to upset somebody if you have a religious-based shoe. I'm just not.
Isn't the blood in the shoe, so it's real human blood. Isn't that some sort of health hazard? What if the shoe breaks open?
You know what I was wondering too, Mike? You gave this good explanation. It's like, okay, they have six managers and there's 666 shoes for once a day. They're pricking themselves with putting a shoe. Okay. Sounds good. That's what the protocol was in theory. Like, so one little prick of blood one day, it wasn't that big of a deal. There is no chance that all six managers were like on it. And every day they were giving one drop of blood. It is very likely. I'm going to almost say a virtual certainty that one of them is the friend that you grew up with in school that like waited until the very end and then crammed for the exam. And he just hasn't used any blood. And he owes like 111 drops of blood on the last day. He's like, oh my God, I have to cut open my hand and I have to put them in a shoe right now. It just doesn't make sense. I've just, hey, I'm talking to work. Oh, you know what? Got to prick myself in the finger and I got to put it in a shoe right now. What kind of a workplace is this? They runs the establishment. What
you
is
got the product someone in manufacturing?
Who is the boss of this place? Why is the statement individually named in this complaint? He clearly
Lil Nas X is also not named in this complaint, just letting you know.
Also,
the project manager showed the little device that they used to prick their finger every day. It was like a little blue with a needle that just took, he said they did like 1,200 drops of blood, each of them.
So, Mike, excellent breakdown. More importantly, this is hashtag Free Britney. can't you see? Stephanie, can you explain? I mean, people are aware that for years that Britney Spears has been under some conservatorship with her father. That's where we are on some shaky legal grounds. But why don't you just break us down from the beginning, how we got here, and then we can talk about where we go.
Yeah, so like you just mentioned, you know, this has been a 13-year conservatorship that essentially prevents Britney Spears from controlling her life in its entirety and her $59 million fortune. That's her net worth as of 2018 financial documents. I believe that's the last known. But it was implemented in 2008 and literally left her with no legal control over her estate or assets. And so we'll get a little legal here. A conservatorship definition is a legal guardianship typically enacted for those incapable of making their own decisions. And so this was approved in Los Angeles Superior Court back in 2008. And this was right after Britney had her several public mental breakdowns. I don't know if you guys remember, like, she was spotted driving her car with her son on her lap and not
hashtag bald Britney. Britney. Yep, exactly.
And then shaved her head and was seen hitting a photographer's car with an umbrella. But she made several trips to rehab that year. And that's when her father, Jamie Spears, petitioned for an emergency temporary conservatorship after her second psychiatric hold. And this arrangement literally gave her father and her lawyer all control over her life. And so this conservatorship generated a lot of controversy among Spears' fans. Dan, I'm sure some of them liked your Instagram post. Everyone thinks she's being controlled and manipulated. So this hashtag Free Britney movement has really kind of exploded, at least in the public eye, over the past few years. And, you know, there was the New York Times released a new Hulu documentary last month. It was called Framing Britney Spears. I watched it. It was actually very well done. You know, it provided some insight into, you know, why she shaved her head. They kind of framed it all around how, you know, the paparazzi was kind of really, really causing her mental health to deteriorate. And so it almost makes you, you know, like her even more from that and want to support the Free Britney movement. So, but essentially now, at least, Jamie Spears has requested to extend his daughter's conservatorship. He did that in 2019. And less than a week after the documentary premiered, her first conservatorship hearing of 2021 occurred. And at that point, the court finally rejected her father's objection to sharing control of her estate and investments. So Jamie Spears, her father, had objected to the proposed co-conservatorship with Bessemer Trust. He tried to argue that improperly reduced his powers over his daughter's estate. Why he thinks he's still entitled to that power, I'm not sure. But essentially now Britney's fighting for her father to be removed from the conservatorship entirely. And like I said, I mean, I'm on board for this Free Britney, you know, movement. A conservatorship is granted for those who are incapable of making a decision. How someone as productive and young as Spears with a $59 million net worth, I'm not sure.
Leave Britney alone. Can I just say how wild it is that Jamie Spears named his daughter Jamie Lynn Spears? That's like George Foreman-esque. That is crazy.
The mom's name is Lynn, right?
Wait, younger sister's name is Jamie Lynn.
I think the dad is Jamie, the mom is Lynn, and they have a younger daughter who was famous for Zoe 101. Shout out to Nickelodeon, Jamie Lynn Spears.
Wow, this is like when I realized that Willow and Jaden Smith are named after Will and Jada Smith. That's crazy.
I just said that, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Smith, who bought into NBA Top Chef.
That's right. Steph's got a great TikTok about it. Everyone should go watch. Britney is an icon. Hadley has Disney Plus, so we're watching some of the comfort movies of our youth, and we're watching Max Keeble's Big Move. Not to brag, but you know that
you were
that,
in. Not to brag, but you were in the movie.
No, I'm not Lil Romeo, unfortunately. But you know that the dun 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 at the beginning of Hit Me Baby, that is such a like an iconic start to a song. Every time the older girl next door that he's supposed to be into enters a scene, they play that dun dun dun, and you're like, in your mind, you get why they're playing that. They're trying to indicate to you this is like the Britney Spears-esque character. So, you know, I think that it's incredible the amount of pressure that she was under at a young age. And I think anybody would go crazy. And that's the reason that we see that a lot of child stars aren't normal. And it's really unfortunate. But I hope that she succeeds in her legal action.
Fun fact, Britney Spears has a song called You Drive Me Crazy. Maybe it was about this conservatorship. Maybe that's what the song was actually about. It was just
like,
conservatorship drives me crazy, but it just doesn't sound as good.
And then her other song, Circus, is about Tony Busby.
And then
Toxic. And his media show.
And then her song, Toxic, is just about Dan Snyder poisoning people, poisoning trees.
With the peanuts, the trees, everything.
Guys, we've got some big brains in here.
Britney Spears is a time traveler.
So, you know, I think the Britney stuff is fascinating. Britney is a fully functioning adult human being. Steph, anything else to add on Britney? I feel like there's a lot. I feel like there's a lot here.
Honestly, there is a ton because it's spanning over 13 years, which in itself is insane. Like, all right, okay, I understand maybe first year or two after she's, you know, trying to get a hang of herself again and get back into the swing of things and, you know, be okay. But then for it to be now, like, she has children, she's
I'm just gonna throw in my two cents here. So to go a little on the legal side here, if nothing comes out of this besides like free Britney and like good for her and support behind Britney Spears, it's also creating this conversation about the laws of conservatorship. Like, California is already reworking their conservatorship like laws, and they're passing bills trying to modify the fact that something's wrong. They're not advocating enough for these individuals who need the conservators. And the fact that she had, in 2008, she had her father assigned and an attorney, Andrew Wallet was his name. He was assigned as the conservator for Britney. Andrew Wallet resigned in 2019 as her conservator, but her father has still been the conservator. So now she's trying to get out of this. Basically, California is passing these bills, or not passing, they're proposing these bills where there's a clear issue here where some of the law, the current law, it prevents those in need of a conservator from choosing who their conservator is. So back in 2008, Britney wanted to pick one. She actually had an attorney lined up that she was going to pick, but they did a medical examination and determined that she was not well enough to make that selection on her own. And that's why they selected them for her. So that clearly right there was an issue where she was overstepped as trying to choose her own conservator. And she ended up having her father and this attorney since 2008.
So that's essentially the Britney saga. I mean, we're gonna keep doing it. I don't know. Well, maybe we'll do a Britney update as long as we have you guys on. We have the late night episodes. We'll keep updating everybody on Free Britney. So, last but not least, our final subject of the podcast. I don't know. We try to plan out the podcast topics like a day in advance. If something comes up, like obviously came up with Watson, we can adjust on the fly. This one came up today, which I just thought was too good not to find a way to get in here. I'm just going to read your tweet. Anybody can guess who this came from. In honor of Rappaport getting his ass kicked in court, here's the time I put his lawyers in a mental torture chamber. Does anyone know who may have tweeted that?
Was it El Prez?
El Prez, correct.
And the deposition is like, what, 7 minutes, 13 seconds? I watched the whole thing. He gave that nice thumbs up at the end. He had some great one-liners back to the other opposing attorney. He is, I think, a dream to his counsel. A dream.
So what we had in this lovely tweet from David Portnoy was a 7-minute video from a deposition that occurred from a case between Michael Rapaport and Dave Portnoy in a lawsuit against Barstool Sports. I'm going to recap it pretty quick because I don't want to spend so much time talking about the lawsuit. I want to talk about deposition tactics for this fifth one, which I think is an interesting thing. So basically, Michael Rapaport was hired by Barstool 2017 at a point in time. They said, we want to get rid of Barstool. So they fired him. And there was a lawsuit that occurred by Michael Rapaport. Michael Rapaport, comedian, he yells at people. I don't really know Michael Rapaport's thing. Also, I learned today that everyone hates Michael Rapaport. I guess closet think he's kind of funny. I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but I just
canceled.
I guess he's not funny anymore. Right? Okay, so I'm okay now. But he sues Barstool because after they fired him, they came out with a shirt that if anybody has seen the Roger Goodell, like looks like a clown shirt with the clown nose and that like teal blue, they did that. I guess this was first. I thought Goodell was always first, but they made this first. And there's a picture, very public picture, that I guess is a real picture. I always thought it was a fake picture, but it's Michael Rapaport with some kind of cold sore on his chin of some sort. But it looks like a real picture. And what Barstool did is they took this picture and they blew it up and they turned him into a clown. And they put a clown nose on him. And they put the shirt on him. And Rapaport basically sued for defamation relating to the shirt, I guess, because it showed that he had potentially herpes. He sued for breach of contract because they fired him. So that's what the case is about. And you can watch this deposition. I think it's very fascinating. So overall insight says the deposition, it's basically, and everyone should watch it. I think it's on Barstool's page, it's on my page, but it's a clip, 7-minute clip of David Portnoy being as Steph put it, an excellent, excellent witness in his own behalf. People can hate Dave Portnoy if they want. They can hate Barstool, but Portnoy certainly put this lawyer in a mental torture chamber. So maybe this is me having taken a couple of depositions in my time. The questions I don't really think were that bad, just being honest. And who's counting? Maybe I've taken 100 depositions, but you guys will get there in due time. You guys are all relatively young lawyers. But the questions I don't think were that bad, truthfully. They can be argumentative in deposition. There's no objection argumentative that would hold weight at a deposition because you can do whatever you want at a deposition. Short of asking someone a question about crimes they committed or, you know, speculating about like the ultimate conclusions of a case, you can get away with a lot at a deposition. And the point of a deposition is that you should be able to ask anything and put it out there. And there are very few things that the other lawyer can't obstruct the other side not to answer. There's a question that's confidential, attorney-client privilege, like the big no-nos. But argumentative, if somebody objects, like also on the other side of the equation, somebody was in my comments saying, oh, like Portnoy's lawyer was pretty weak with those objections. The truth is, like when you grow up as a baby lawyer, like somebody once taught me, like the first time I defended a deposition, they're like, just object to everything because you preserve the objections. Even if you don't say why you're objecting, just object to everything so you can preserve it. And if something goes really bad and you think your client's in a lot of trouble, just object and make sure you have it on the record. And nothing can go wrong, but everything's going to come out of deposition. And he goes, worst case is you direct your client not to answer. And then what happens is you mark it for a ruling. The other side files a motion. And a month later, maybe you come back and you have to answer the question that you were refraining from answering. So you could object to anything. Questions are, I think, fair game. What I thought was mental torture chamber-esque. I love Portnoy. Portnoy is just the man. I mean, people can hate Portnoy. I just think Portnoy is the man. I'm just, you can hate me for saying that. Portnoy, if I was going up against Portnoy, and like, I'd probably be nervous. This guy is really smart. He's really savvy. And he's going to take the case into his own hands. And that's kind of what happened here. Like, I don't know if Portnoy's lawyer is any good. I have no idea. For all we know, maybe it's like his dad, who's also a lawyer. Maybe his dad was doing the defending. I have no idea who was doing it. All I know is that Portnoy was the star of that show and literally crumbled Rapoport's case in a matter of 7 minutes. So apparently, I guess what the legal argument here, if you're watching this deposition, and I don't really, actually, take one step back. There is no reason in a deposition, none, to give the other side your case on a silver platter and ask them to acknowledge it or deny. Usually what you do is you walk pretty finely up to the line and you kind of in a way you're asking questions that get to your point. And if you string them together, you'll have your really good question that you could ask, you know, cross-examination at trial. you don't put it on a silver platter, your ultimate conclusion. You don't tell Portnoy basically what the theory of your case is and then let him reject it. And then he's aware of what your case theory is. Theory here was that this shirt, this like herpes clown shirt, was created, according to the Rappaport's lawyer, prior to Rappaport's firing. And they were just looking for an excuse to release a shirt that had already been created, which, I don't know, they're looking for a pretense to fire him. So I guess that would amount to wrongful termination if they were looking for something to fire him for, right? Now, I guess this guy, does anybody know the name of the episode of the blog that they cite to?
I am Crappaport.
So it's the Portnoy blog, I am Crappaport? Is that the name of the episode?
It's a stool scene. So like their office documentary kind of thing.
So the lawyer actually had to read I am Crappaport, but I don't know how much research. This guy maybe did a Mike Lawson level of deep dive into stool scenes. And he got really deep, like really, really deep into it. And then he's just like, I got it. I got the case. I have it right here. He said in this one scene that like I made the shirt first. And Portnoy, watch the last 2 minutes of the video if you don't want to watch the whole thing. Portnoy watches the video and goes, oh, well, you didn't obviously watch that video because obviously it proves the exact opposite thing. And then the best line of the video, he goes, that went well. Just eviscerating.
And he gives a look to his lawyer. Like just everyone knows how badly the other attorney had shit the bed.
I think the other attorney even knew how badly. He literally was like, okay, I understand what you're saying. And just like, mic drop.
Well, if that was their only evidence, like I think he just picked the wrong evidence. If they're actually trying to find like ways that, Portnoy and Barstool created this pretense of firing him, this video was not it, because it explicitly said, if you go through the video and you'll watch it, like he sent a text. And first of all, he fired the wrong Rappaport. What was that?
I think there's another guy named Mike, and he fired the other Mike.
He texted Mike the Rappaport. Wrong guy that he was fired first. Then he fired Mike Rappaport, and then he texted his t-shirt guy to make the t-shirt. So that's what the video is saying. So if they're, I don't know why they picked that as their evidence, and he tried to ask him. So that's definitely why this video looks horrible, because it's like that was a terrible evidence to use in your argument that they had a pretense, because it was very clear that the chain of events was fired Mike, made the t-shirt. So
do you know how you know this went bad for the lawyer? If you were, I think the first exhibit he wants to show Portnoy is exhibit 2. Okay, so he goes, look at exhibit 2, and it's like Crappaport stooly scenes, whatever he shows him. And then he kind of has like a malfunction. He doesn't know what to do after Portnoy schools him. And he's like, directing your attention to exhibit 50. It's like, what? How did we get from 2 to 50? What's going on? Get yourself together. Like maybe go to exhibit 3. Like you had a complete malfunction. Like I'll throw him off the scent. I'm going to jump all the way to 50. I don't even know 50 exists. I'm just going to say it.
It looks too in the video that Portnoy is flipping something. I think he maybe flipped one page and then he was like, "No, I'm not looking for it." he just there's clearly pages in front of him that he's flipping, but he kind of gave up at that point. He's like, "I'm not looking for it."
That definitely goes up there with some of the all-time best depositions. Another one that we watched in our civil procedure class is Lil Wayne's deposition from a few years ago. Ooh, highly recommend that. Yeah. That is really, that's a fun watch.
You know what's a horrendous watch? The Jeffrey Epstein deposition, when he's just like, I've been directed not to answer. I've been directed not to answer.
Has been charged.
I did see that with one case, Mike.
Yeah, one so far.
Okay, so as I think we can put Barstool in the books. So I'm gonna put you guys on the spot. So we're about to finish this one up. We've done this a couple times. I always have fun, documentaries and whatnot. Is there anything? We'll open up the floor. What are you watching for? What is on the docket of sports documentaries? Anything sports related, law related that you guys are watching?
I can go first. Definitely tomorrow, looking forward to oral arguments. I think that's probably on everyone here's radar and something that we've been spending a lot of time talking about and dissecting. And it's just really exciting that it's finally here. It's kind of like waiting for the Super Bowl where you talk about it for 2 weeks and then finally you get to play the game. I'm also just looking forward to the Final Four. I don't think anybody can beat Gonzaga. They looked excellent again tonight, but it'll be fun to watch some other teams try. And I've got a really good friend who is a Baylor alum and reports on the team now. So for his sake, I'm hoping that maybe they can pull the upset in the national championship. That'd be fun.
Michigan is currently losing by 1 point to UCLA. So that should be interesting.
They're going to win. They're going to win. Michigan's too good.
I think for something that I'm looking forward to, definitely Major League Baseball opening day. That's coming up. April is upon us. And I think this is going to be an interesting year for baseball. After last year with the 60 game season, a full season of baseball again, definitely looking forward to that.
Yeah. And I guess one thing that I'm looking forward to and that everyone is invited to, all the listeners out there, next week on Wednesday and Thursday, April 7th and 8th, is the New York Law School Sports Law Symposium. And we have some pretty awesome keynote speakers this year. Among them, we have Emerson Moore. He's the Executive Vice President, Chief People Officer for BSA Global, AKA Brooklyn Nets. And then I have the privilege of moderating with Mr. Mark Lazary, co-owner of the Milwaukee Bucks. Probably talk a little NBA Top Shot, a little bit on Giannis, who knows, but everyone is obviously welcome to join that. And we hope to see you there.
Stephanie, thanks for the shout out. I appreciate it. I'm also,
oh my God, I totally forgot. I totally spaced.
Great.
That's the biggest keynote guest there is.
Yeah, no, you're looking forward to speaking with everyone else, but me, it's great. Excited to be speaking at New York Sports Law Symposium. I'm speaking at the Cardozo Sports Law Symposium the day prior, but my thing to watch for, I can't recommend this enough. It's my favorite show. I don't know if this is blasphemous. I love Drive to Survive on Netflix. It is so, so, so good. And it has single-handedly turned me into a Formula One fan. I've joined a Formula One fantasy league, which is as intense as you would think it is.
That sounds fake.
It's 100% real. It is very similar to the English Premier League style with transfers in, guys go up with salaries. It's very interesting. So if you want to go down a rabbit hole of Formula One with me, get into Drive to Survive first. Guys, anything else to add before we put this in the books? Let's see if I can nail this time. Dan Wallach will be joining us for our next episode. He's at Wallach Legal. Myself, Dan Lust, at Sports Law Lust. Mike Lawson is at Mike_son_of_law. Stephanie is at, she's got two.
I know.
You do them. What do you got?
Long last name. Twitter won't let me make my Instagram the same. On Twitter, SWeisenberger_, and then on Instagram, Steph_explains_it_all.
Okay. And Taryn also has a new handle. Taryn, why don't you give us your new handle?
I'm still at TK Sharma Law on Twitter, and then same thing, but Sports Law on Instagram. But more importantly, go follow our TikTok. It's at @condetrimental. Stephanie and I are posting good content there, educate you on issues in a little under a minute, and we're really excited about it. So,
and follow the new clubhouse that Taryn created that we just used today, myself and Mike Meltzer doing a Deshaun Watson clubhouse.
Yeah, we're calling that Sports Law Talk.
Sports Law Talk, sponsored by Conduct Detrimental, because we need to open up to the masses. We talk sports. We don't just talk about Free Britney. Okay, we leave that in the Conduct Detrimental clubhouse. We talk sports.
Yeah, so Sports Law Talk. We had a great first event, as Dan mentioned, and we're going to have more of those coming up. It'll be a fun way for us to engage with everyone that listens to the podcast and hear what everyone else thinks on these issues.
Okay. Well, that will put this episode of Conduct Detrimental in the books. As always, we will see you maybe again this week, perhaps, on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.
It's Brittany, bitch. And I am back